Okay, the indulgences of the holidays are behind us, and dry January is trending. Maybe you've seen posters at your doctor's office or social media posts from people giving up drinking alcohol for a month. But it is more than a fad for those who struggle with alcohol abuse or other substance abuse addictions. While the opioid crisis rightfully gets a lot of attention, far more people die each year from alcohol. Researchers from the University of Washington found that the number of deaths attributable to alcohol rose from 35% from 2007 to 2017, and that Georgia is the state with the second highest rates of deaths, followed by Alabama at number three. Neil Campbell is executive director of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse and is joining me now in the studio. Neil, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Amanda Abraham, she's joining us from WUGA in Athens. She's assistant professor of public administration and policy at the University of Georgia and studies treatment options for substance abuse. Hello, Amanda.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much. Neil, going to start with you, an official from the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, which authored the study I quoted, says the real story here is no one has noticed the slow rise in deaths attributed to alcohol. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because it's socially acceptable in a lot of ways. I think that it's difficult to measure when someone goes from drinking in a normal way to drinking in a problem way, in a risky or health risky way. So I think a lot of those factors just play. It's such a socially acceptable thing in our culture.
It's harder. It's slower moving, I suppose, and harder to criticize. Amanda, what are some alcohol-related diseases or causes of death? Amanda, are you with us?
Yes. So alcohol is associated with a range of health conditions, including several types of cancer, cirrhosis of the liver, of course, puts people at higher risk for accidents, car accidents, and other types of accidents as well.
Well, we've heard reports in recent years that drinking a glass of red wine may be beneficial to the health. So what is considered alcoholic drinking? Who wants to pick that up, Neil?
Oh, that's a good question. The National Institutes on Health have limits for both males and females, depending on body weight, depending on how much you've used in the past. So you can measure, you can figure that out, what is harmful use and what's not for yourself. I think that it really is dependent on where you're coming from, what your history is, and all of those factors that play into it. I want to just mention that we have a program up in Northeast Georgia where we have peer recovery coaches in emergency departments who talk to people who have either experienced overdose or any other kind of substance issue. And alcohol by far is the most is the reason that most people are coming into the emergency rooms as well. So it's not only just health conditions, it's also what's bringing people to the attention of officials, either in an emergency room setting or in police department with DUIs and things like that.
Yeah, it looks like epidemiologists have been really looking at alcohol, have seen a huge rise in ER visits because of alcohol. And we're going to put this conversation on hold for just a minute while we take a break. We're talking about the disease and treatment of alcoholism with Neil Campbell, executive director of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse. And Amanda Abraham is also with us, assistant professor of public administration and policy at UGA. Stay with us. We're continuing the conversation right after the break. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is dry January in Britain, where the idea originated. More than 3 million are off the sauce for the first month of the year. It's caught on in the U.S. as a public health campaign and social media trend. And while the opioid crisis deserves a lot of attention, there are far more alcohol-attributed deaths in the U.S. each year. We're talking about the disease and treatment of alcoholism with Neil Campbell, executive director of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse, and Amanda Abraham. She's assistant professor of public administration and policy at UGA. So is the increase in heavy or binge drinking within any particular populations, Neil, that you've noticed?
I think it's always a concern with young people, especially in colleges. There's a social researcher named Bill White who says that colleges are abstinence-hostile environments where a lot of social activities are around alcohol, and you know, sometimes young people don't have the best judgment around their use, and it's just used as kind of central to everything that they do. I know in my case, I also wanted to mention I'm a person in recovery from alcoholism. And for me, that means it's been a little over 28 years since I've had my last drink.
Well, congratulations.
Right, thank you. And I speak about it because I want everybody to know that it's possible. And when I was in college, you know, there's parts of my undergrad I don't remember because of alcohol and because it was just so available and just so sort of the expectation as well.
So that is the social, let's say, social atmosphere for alcohol and alcoholism and binge drinking especially to develop. But now we have an idea, or we're characterizing alcoholism as a diagnosis, alcohol substance abuse disorder?
Substance use disorder.
Okay, mm-hmm. So this is in the DSM, the Diagnostic mm-hmm. and Statistic Manual. But you said you're in long-term recovery. Now, isn't that something where you sort of diagnose yourself? You say, I have a problem?
I got to that point where I did. I could say I had a problem. So I would wake up every day, you know, before I was 30, I was right around, I got better when I was 30. I got sober when I was 30, but I would wake up every day and say, I am not going to drink today. And every day I drank. It wasn't until I had some social support, I didn't hang around anybody who didn't drink. I didn't trust anybody who didn't drink. So I eventually got to know someone who was in recovery, and he just noticed that I was having some of the symptoms, and some of the things that happened in his life were happening in my life. And he said, it doesn't have to be like this. And that was the first time I heard. I thought, this is just what it's going to happen. I'm going to hit bottom. I'm either going to die or go to jail. And I realized it didn't have to be like that because someone else told me, someone who had been through it.
But now, more and more, we know a lot more about brain science and how drugs and alcohol affect the brain. And this idea of the diagnosis of alcohol substance abuse disorder, it's medicalizing it. It's identifying alcoholism as a disease. How does that change the thinking around alcoholism?
Well, hopefully I think it's a good thing, actually. I think I'd love to hear Amanda's thoughts on this as well. I think we should have a public health approach to addiction and to substance use and people with substance use disorders. I think you're right. Brain science does say that we have this powerfully reinforcing psychoactive substance in our brains that's causing us to think a certain way or act a certain way. So it's got behavioral implications, but it's that substance that's in our brains that's affecting our neurotransmitters, right? So it's not so easy as just to say, you know, this is a moral weakness. It's just a crutch. You need to stop. We know that that's not the case. Again, in my own experience, I know that's not the case. It's not until, you have a series of interventions. For some people, like for me, I needed to have a couple of things happen before I actually got better. However, what it's also showing us, if you think of it like diabetes, you don't have to be in a diabetic coma to get better. You don't have to hit bottom to get better. You can pull this back anytime. You can stop. We always say the elevator gets off at every floor. Let's figure out ways that help you, whether it's reducing drinking or drug use or whatever it is that's working in your life.
How about that, Amanda? How does looking at the medical aspect or the brain aspect of alcoholism change the way that we think about treatment?
I think that really can reduce the stigma associated with addiction. Like Neil just stated, there is a moral aspect and people get stigmatized, and the idea that people could just stop drinking if they wanted to. But the idea, of course, that it is a chronic medical condition that will require a lifetime of care, just like diabetes or hypertension would, is really changing that. And we also have medical treatments available to people with alcohol and opioid use disorder in a range of evidence-based treatment options for people. And again, I think that medicalizing it reduces the stigma associated with it, and hopefully that'll get more people into treatment, because right now, only about 10% of people that need treatment in a given year actually seek treatment. And a lot of that is related to insurance, the barriers related to insurance, and also the stigma associated with seeking treatment.
Well, I want to dig into that a little bit, because it seems that this has become a bit of a rift within the rehabilitation or treatment community, the idea that there is a sort of spiritual problem. That's the 12-step approach, that, you know, there's something that's something that makes you want to drink. And then there is the more medicalized idea that you can get treatments that embrace all of these kind of techniques that block receptors or craving receptors for alcoholism. Amanda, can you help us understand some of the distinctions between those?
Absolutely. So really, there are a lot of evidence-based treatment services available to patients. And so that's really what we want to see people get. And that could be behavioral therapies that are evidence-based, so things like motivational interviewing, cognitive behavioral therapy. And there's also medications that are FDA-approved to treat both alcohol and opioid use disorder. And so I really don't view it as one or the other. It's really up to the individual patient and their provider to decide what is the best treatment course for them. And that might include medications and behavioral therapy or behavioral therapy alone. It's really not a one-size-fits-all treatment that is appropriate for all patients.
Well, it seems like every couple of years we see articles or disputes over whether AA or 12-step programs are evidence-based, though they're relied on by some calculations about 85% of rehabs across the country. So Amanda doesn't see it as a rift. How about you, Neil?
It's a rift within the recovery communities, for sure. Mm-hmm. I know in a lot of 12-step, well, I'll just go back old school. Mm-hmm. You know, you were told, I was told when I walked into the rooms, you are not to be on any medication. Whether it was an SSRI, an antidepressant type, or whether it was something that was helping with the cravings, you were told that's not real recovery. That's starting to change, and we think that's a good thing. You would never tell someone who suffers from diabetes that this medication is not for you if it worked. I mean, there are certain medications and certain things that work for certain people at certain times. And I also want to mention that there's a cultural component to all of this. You can't, you know, if you go to a substance abuse rehab and you don't complete that rehab, so many times we're told that's your fault. It's not the fault. You know, you're to blame. You're mm-hmm. not ready for this. Mm-hmm. Go out and do more research. Well, that kills people in many times, right? You have to, it's not just that, because if you go to a doctor for diabetes and he tells you, hey, this drug isn't working, we'll try something else. Why don't we do that in substance use as well? We should be trying other things that work for other people. Because like Amanda said, with the stigma, that keeps many people from getting help. There's in certain neighborhoods, in certain cultures, you're not going to go and look for help and go to where those people go, right? So I think we have to look at the whole, in a holistic way, we got to look at communities. And if only 10% of the folks who need treatment are getting it, how are people staying well? Because people are staying well. We see it all the time. There's communities that are standing up and saying, hey, we want to take care of people. We want to make some recovery-friendly spaces. We want to make sure everybody can get the help that they need.
Well, we've heard over and over again during the opioid crisis that the opposite of addiction is community, that there needs to be not just one person involved, but they have to feel a sense of belonging. Is that the value of being a part of like the AA groups or fellowships?
Yeah, absolute. Connection is everything. And addiction can be very isolating. It can be very scary. We always say the opposite of addiction is connection. It's human connection. We operate a peer support warm line where you can call 365 days out of the year between 8:30 and 11 at night just to get a peer recovery coach on the other end of the phone to listen. We call it radical listening. We're not trying to push anybody a certain way or pull them a certain way. We're just there to say, hey, we've been there and we can help. And because we believe people know what's best for them.
We're talking about alcoholism today and treatment and various different kinds of treatments. It's something that has changed a lot, especially during the huge opioid crisis that has overtaken the United States. Do you think, Amanda, that has changed the landscape of opioid treatment over the past few years? Do you think people are aware of addiction differently? And do you think that opioids and alcoholism need to be treated differently?
I think that the opioid crisis has brought a lot of attention and a lot of funding and a lot of opportunities to the addiction treatment system. And I think that's positive. As we stated before, alcohol does affect more people than opioids, but the crisis itself has brought a lot of much needed attention to the issue generally. And I think that could be leveraged in a very positive way to increase access and quality of both treatment for alcohol and opioid use disorder. And so I do think it is bringing attention to it and changing the way that people think about it and really, again, promoting a more medical view of this, not as a moral issue, but as a chronic brain disease.
Well, your research focuses on addiction health services. What kind of services exist here in Georgia for people suffering from addiction?
There's a range of services available for people in Georgia with substance use disorder across the continuum of care. That includes outpatient services, inpatient and residential, and recovery support services. We also have over 50 opioid treatment programs in the state, which are licensed to dispense methadone. And then outside the specialty treatment system, we have office-based providers that are waivered to prescribe buprenorphine for opioid use disorder treatment. And I would say really the services available to Georgians depend on where they live, because that can affect your access to treatment and what type of insurance people have.
Yeah,
so there are some... Go ahead.
Well, what kind of barriers do insurance create for people who want to or need treatment?
Well, a lot of people with substance use disorder simply don't have health insurance. And so about 50% of people seeking treatment prior to Medicaid expansion actually lacked insurance at all. And then there are barriers. If you do have insurance, does your insurance cover the type of treatment that you need? And then are there utilization controls or limits put on those services? So, for example, a lot of health insurers require prior authorization for buprenorphine, which is a medication used to treat opioid use disorder. So that creates additional paperwork essentially for the provider. So it's an administrative burden. And it also may cause patients to have to wait up to 3 days to receive treatment. And that's not what we really want to do. If someone's finally ready to seek treatment, we don't want to try and make them wait, for them to have to wait for several days to actually access that treatment.
Right. So what? I'm sorry, Amanda.
No, go ahead.
What other preventable, treatable chronic health condition do you know where you have to actually have that kind of authorization? You don't.
That's a great point. Exactly.
So people are kept from treatment. And the insurance company, the insurance world has not caught up with what really helps with substance use disorders. It's not something that you can treat in an acute care setting. Right. Because treatment for many people is just the beginning of recovery. So recovery supports have to be in place. And
absolutely,
the insurance companies don't pay for that typically.
Well, it's interesting because the Trump administration was initially critical of medication assisted treatment, from my understanding that, you know, the idea was we're just substituting one opioid for another. But now, after the announcement of $1 billion in grants to expand access, it emphasized that only programs that made these medicines available would be eligible. So what does that mean for, you know, traditional recovery centers for, as you mentioned, cognitive behavioral therapy, recovery in 12-step groups?
They're catching up, too. I mean, I think it's causing us to sort of expand our view of what this is. And I agree with Amanda, that's a good thing. It's having us look at this as a chronic health condition, as opposed to just something that can be treated one way. So I think you have to have a lot of options for folks, especially, you know, a lot of the young people who are coming into services. It's going to look a lot different for someone who is recovering from opiate use disorder in the long term than it is maybe for someone who's coming in for a cocaine use disorder. So it's just it's different. It's having us realize that recovery is, first of all, it's deeply personal, and that it comes in a lot of different ways to people.
Why is it so much worse? Deaths from alcoholism, can both of you, looking at this system in states like Georgia, in states like Alabama, what can states be doing to change the outcomes?
Well, every state has an official that's in charge of all of the federal money and the state money that comes through their offices. And so they're starting to recognize that recovery supports are very important. Things like recovery, peer recovery coaching, things like having, you know, having this screening in schools where young people are getting a message that it's, you know, of health and of actual good education around what this does to your brain. Because if you tell kids, what we have do some work at Decatur High School, and if you let them know what's really going on and give them good, honest information, kids will back off of their harmful use. They can do that. So I think states are responding in a lot of creative ways, and I think it's actually really good.
How about the traditional, you know, putting a higher tax on alcohol, restricting hours, that kind of thing? Are those effective?
I think putting, you know, these sin taxes, I think, can work. I think as long as they're going to fund real grassroots or real treatment and getting to the people. Sometimes that doesn't happen. It's just used to buy equipment or whatever. But so I think some of those taxes can be a good thing. I don't have the evidence in front of me of whether they work or not. But I think that's an example of a creative way to think about some solutions.
Amanda, what have you seen?
In terms of?
What is effective for states helping to actually curb alcoholism or alcohol abuse disorder?
I think that one thing that states that haven't done this could do would be expand Medicaid, because what we've really seen in states that have done this is that they've decreased the number of uninsured people with a substance use disorder, alcohol or opioid use disorder, that then have access to treatment through Medicaid. And that's really, you know, very important step that the state could take. And that also allows the state, because a lot of people who are uninsured are going to be funded through a federal block grant or other local funds. So the state would be able to recapture those funds and use them in ways that best serve the needs of the state.
Yeah, we have to wrap, but what should somebody, given the variety of treatments and options, who feels like they're really out of control, their drinking has gotten to them, where should they go?
Well, I would encourage people to call 844-326-5400 is a recovery support warm line where they can talk to a peer recovery coach to see what their next step is. There isn't one right answer for anyone, but I would say talk about it, reach out for help. We have at the Georgia Council, there's 35 people that work for us. All of us are in long-term recovery. So I just want to give that message of hope that someone, that you're not alone, that it's nothing to be ashamed about. There's hope, and there are people out there who really want to help.
Neil Campbell, Executive Director of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Amanda Abraham, Assistant Professor of Public Administration and Policy. She's at UGA. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time that we have for today. I'm Virginia Prescott. We thank you so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.